Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. TGIF, happy Friday, Shabbat Shalom. Welcome to our end of the week program. Coming up today in the second hour of our program, Roland Manarin is our Everything You Know Is Wrong guest. He claims the Federal Reserve System is ripping us off. We'll find out how. And in the third hour of our program, Jeffrey Kleinman with DVD Talk will be telling us about the latest DVD flicks with a message. So that plus just a whole absolute huge pile of news to get through and lots of things happening in the world. But first, our first hour of the Friday, as always, Congressman Bernie Sanders, our Brunch with Bernie segment. Congressman Bernie Sanders, the longest-serving member of the House of Representatives who is not affiliated with a political party, an independent. And Bernie now running for the United States Senate, his website, bernie.org. And Bernie, of course, pleased to take your phone calls. Our toll-free number all across the United States, 866-440-8466, 440-THOM. And if you want to drop into our live chat room, tomhartman.com. Bernie, welcome.
Good to be with you, Tom.
Great to have you here with us. Bernie, I want to talk to you about oil. Before I do, though, there's an email that I got from a listener that you're going to love this question because I know in advance how you're going to reply, but oddly enough, I've had a number of people ask this question. She notes this listener, or Paul is his name. He writes in and he says, Melanie Sloan with Crew is a regular guest on a number of talk shows, and she reports on ethics violations in Congress. And whenever asked, why doesn't this get investigated, her reply is always, I need at least one congressman or senator to file these charges, which makes it sound like there's some kind of gun held to their heads afraid of retaliation. And really, it's who controls the House and the Senate, isn't
right.
it?
Right. I mean,
so explain that to our listeners.
Here's what the story is, and a lot of people just don't know this. Right now in the United States, we have a one-party government. So obviously, the president is Republican. Leadership of the House is Republican. Leadership of the Senate is Republican. What I can tell you about in the House is control of what happens there is very, very tight. Nothing happens. No piece of legislation gets to the floor of the House unless the leadership wants it to get to the floor of the House. One of the issues that many Americans, no matter what their political persuasion may be, are very concerned about is that major problems facing our country, allegations against the Bush administration, for example, are never seriously investigated. Why is that? Why do we have investigations with regard to the Clinton administration every other week, but nothing is seriously investigated about President Bush? And the answer is the Republican leadership sees their role now as being a rubber stamp for the Bush administration rather than an independent branch of government which performs oversight and investigatory functions. And that's the answer, Tom.
So unless the Democrats achieve a majority in either the House or the Senate, there will not be a situation where a congressman or a senator has the legal right to, quote, file these charges or start an investigation of something
happens,
that the Republicans don't want to investigate.
I mean, what happens is Republicans control every single committee. That's what they control. And if you're interested, for example, of understanding what President Bush knew and when he knew it about Iraq, is he telling the truth that we got into the war because he got faulty information? If you want people from the Bush administration to be testifying under oath and answering hard questions, it is, to my mind, not going to happen so long as the Republicans continue to control every single committee. So if the Democrats can gain control of the House or the Senate, or hopefully both, I think you're going to suddenly see a lot of investigations and a lot of questions being asked that have not been asked in 5 years.
Yeah, now I just finished doing my local show here on AM 620 KPOJ in Portland, Oregon, and we had a guest on, a fellow who's with the Institute for Policy Studies, you know, a long CV with lots of PhDs and everything else about oil. And he said that there's a broad consensus among policy analysts that probably in September, October, perhaps timed around the elections, Bush may actually attack Iran, and that our oil policies are at the root of all this, of both our addiction to oil and the need for the Republicans to hold control of the House and Senate. What's going on with oil right
well,
now?
Well, I don't know the answer, you know, to what's going to happen in September and October, and I certainly hope, you know, very strongly that that is not the case, that he will not use a war for political purposes in September or October. What is going on with gas, I think everybody who is driving a car right now knows. You don't need a PhD in energy economics to know what's going on. What's going on is the American people are being ripped off in Vermont. Gas is now in many places over $2.90 a gallon. Meanwhile, this is going on, Tom, at a time when oil inventories are at their highest level in 8 years. This is going on at a time when oil profits of the big oil companies are at the highest, I think, that they have ever been. Last year, ExxonMobil reported a $36 billion in profit, which is more than any other corporation in the history of the world has ever reported. This is going on. You know, the absurdity here, the degree to which the big oil companies are just sticking out their tongues and laughing at the American people can be reflected in no better way than they're saying, oh, you're paying $3 for a gallon of gas? Well, guess what? We're going to be giving the CEO of ExxonMobil, Lee Raymond, a $398 million retirement package.
Yeah.
So, I mean, what is there to say? They are charging, you know, we went through this last year because of Hurricane Katrina, and the argument was, well, the oil refineries were down and we couldn't produce oil and all that stuff. Well, that's no longer now the case. So why are oil prices soaring upward and presumably are going to get even higher as the summer comes? And the answer is they are doing it because they can do it. They are getting away with murder and nobody is stopping them. Now, what Congressman Peter DeFazio of Oregon and I have proposed in a letter to the president is an emergency energy summit, which brings together the administration, the leadership of the Republican and Democratic parties, consumer organizations, and certainly the oil companies, to convene in the White House so that we can begin to work out a policy to short-term lower the outrageously high price of gas, which is impacting the lives of millions and millions of people. Secondly, develop a long-term approach to move us away from fossil fuels and Mideast oil into sustainable energy. But, Tom, you know, it's a funny thing. You have, as you and I have talked about very often, a White House which almost considers itself an imperial presidency, right?
Absolutely.
You know, if they want to tap your telephone or go into your email, they don't have to go to a court. They're very powerful. That's what being president of the United States is about.
He's the decider.
He's the decider, man. And you will remember a few years ago we had this whole tragedy with the Terri Schiavo family, one family undergoing terrible anguish. Well, there was the President of the United States, the whole United States Congress, prepared to jump into the affairs of one family. Now, what I want to know is when you have tens of millions of working Americans getting ripped off every day at the gas pump, when you have family farmers can't afford the high price of gas, the aviation industry suffering, the trucking industry being decimated, where is the President of the United States? Why isn't he having, every day he's having another press conference. Why isn't he having a press conference in front of a gas tank in Washington, D.C., at some service station, pointing out to the $3 per gallon and saying to the oil companies, guess what? You are going to stop ripping off the American people, or we're going to impose a windfall profits tax, or I am going to get authority from Congress to have a cap on the price that you can pay. And we are going to do away with all of the corporate welfare that you have received and are receiving. And we're going to stop this nonsense by which you are going to be able to extract $65 billion worth of oil from public lands without paying any royalty. And on it goes. You're not going to continue to rip off American consumers. You're not going to continue to have a very negative impact on our entire economy. Well, where is the imperial president now? Where is the decider now? Well, I guess, you know, you can't stand up to the oil industry. They're your campaign contributors. They're your old buddies.
Well, Bush and Cheney are the oil industry, aren't they? I mean, Condi Rice? They're all oil industry barons.
That's right. I mean, and so this is the reality. The imperial president, the real tough guy, man, is he tough. But he ain't so tough when it comes to standing up to his friends in the oil industry who are ripping off the American people. So what we're going to try to do is when we get back to Washington on Tuesday, is to gather support from as many members of Congress to push this president to start doing the right thing. And, you know, there is an election coming up. And trust me, it's not only in the state of Vermont where I'm getting telephone calls where people are really upset about the high price of gas. It's, I am sure, every district in America, from the West Coast, East Coast, South, Midwest, whatever. And people want action, and we're going to do our best to force this president to do the right thing.
Yeah, well, good on you. We really need a comprehensive approach to this thing, and I think that, you know, your strategy, what you and Peter DeFazio have talked about looking at where do we go forward over the long term as well as what do we do over
right.
the short term is just so important. Congressman Bernie Sanders, it's our Brunch with Bernie segment, Bernie.org, Bernie Sanders' website. If you want to check it out, I strongly encourage you. Great source of news and information about all sorts of things, even including his run for the Senate. Our telephone number, 1-866-440-8466. We'll be back with your calls right after this at 16 minutes past the hour on the Tom Hartman Program.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Welcome to George Bush National Park, where the air smells just like diesel. And there ain't no animals left around here except snakes, skunks, rats, and weasels.
And welcome back, my friends. 21 minutes past the hour, it's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Where reason is our lifestyle choice. Our Brunch with Bernie segment, Congressman Bernie Sanders with us, the congressman from independent congressman from the great state of Vermont, running for the United States Senate from Vermont, Bernie.org, his website, our toll-free telephone number all across the United States, 1-866-440-8466. I believe you can call it even from outside the country. And, of course, if you want to drop into our live chat room, go to TomHartman.com and click the live chat link. Gary in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, you're live with Bernie Sanders.
Good morning, Senator Sanders.
Yeah. Congressman, I appreciate the sentiment. Thanks very much.
I hope yes, you deserve it.
Thank you.
You're very legitimate. Tom, good morning.
Morning, Gary.
Two things, if I may. One is a question, the other is a short vision here. The question I have, what's your opinion? I have the opinion that the Democratic nominee must elect a vice presidential candidate will energize not only the Democratic base, Ohio especially, the swing state, and the swing voters. And I believe that man is Senator Obama. I would like you to know your opinion on that.
Okay.
Well, I'm not going to get involved in presidential politics of 2008. That's a little too far into the future. What I will say is Barack Obama came to Vermont on behalf of my candidacy. He came to support me a couple of months ago, and we had just an incredible turnout for him at the University of Vermont, Burlington, Vermont. In fact, it was an embarrassment for us because so many people came, we couldn't fit them into the room that we had, which seated close to 1,000 people. So what I can tell you about Barack Obama, he is inspiring a whole lot of folks all over this country, especially young people. He is giving them hope. He is urging them strongly to get involved in the political process. My understanding is that in Illinois, where he is the junior senator, he is also very, very popular. So he is clearly somebody to be looking at in the future of American politics.
Darren in Seattle, Washington, you're live with Congressman Bernie Sanders.
Hey, Bernie. Tom, how you doing?
Good.
Good.
Hey, my main point, you're talking about oil and all that. Definitely, I think the oil machine is taking over, and they're hitting us where it hurts. But my main point is the way that we could hit them the hardest is to quit buying oil. And I know, you know, that statement is very clean. You know, I know that that's a very easy thing to say, but in little increments, we can hit them where it hurts. I've been driving a old 88 Suburban diesel vehicle for almost a year now. And I'm not buying into the oil machine anymore, at least that side of it. And I think that people...
You're running it on biodiesel, you mean?
Yes, biodiesel.
And how's that working?
It's working great.
Where are you getting your biodiesel from?
I live in Seattle, and right now there's a handful, maybe five stations in the Seattle surrounding area that carry 100%, or it's actually 99% pure biodiesel. So there's only 1% regular diesel, and you know, the product is by local company. The plants that are grown come from the Midwest. They're going to try to start making it out here in Washington, and more people are doing this.
Yes, you're absolutely right, and I think this is something that the federal government obviously has got to encourage. It will help farmers, it will protect our environment, and in fact will break our dependence on fossil fuel and Mideast oil. So I applaud you, and you're right. More and more people are looking at that, and that's exactly the kind of research and development and infrastructure that we have got to fund.
Darren, thanks for the call.
Thank
Max
you,
in Eau Claire, Wisconsin on the line. Max, you're live with Congressman Bernie Sanders. Good.
Hello, Congressman. How you doing?
Good.
Say, Tom, I talked to you. You're my educator. Remember, I talked to you here a while back, a couple years ago or something, and you're my educator.
Well, thank you, Max.
My teacher.
So what's your question for Bernie?
Respect. Pardon me?
Well, thank you very much. What's your question for Bernie?
Okay. Hey, Bernie, I'm going to tell you something. I own my own semi.
Yep.
I have no payments on it.
Mm-hmm.
My system, I'm a one truck owner. I thought I could do very well. I pulled it off the road for a year and went to work for a company and got back on my feet. Paid all my bills off instead of bankruptcy and took care of the whole works. And I thought 2 months ago that, I could probably go out here and make a living at this, but the fuel costs right now, the companies that you lease to are not looking after us, which they are, that's what their job is. And fuel costs are just enormous.
Right.
They have risen 50 cents a gallon, and we are not passing it to the customers.
Right. We have heard this call many times right on this program, and I've certainly talked to truckers in the state of Vermont. The trucking industry is getting killed. The truckers, the drivers are under tremendous pressure. People are losing money. And this is having an impact not only on the industry, but on the prices that the American consumer is going to pay. And that's why President Bush has got to stand up and tell the oil industry enough is enough.
Well said. Brunch with Bernie. Congressman Bernie Sanders with us for this entire hour. Our telephone number, 866-440-8466. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, the place where despair is not an option. Get active, my friends. 27 minutes past the hour. I'll be right back.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
Acid rain is not a problem, said a businessman. But all the fish are belly up and floating round. And there's nothing growing from the ground. Just ask Farmer Brown. On the corner are some activists with picket signs. They want the factories to stop their filthy ways. But the government says it's okay, it'll go away any day. Acid rain is up my nose and in my eyes.
And welcome back. It's Earth Day this weekend. Thus, the environmental bumper music. Welcome back to our program. 34 minutes past the hour is the Tom Hartman Radio Show. And on with us live, Congressman Bernie Sanders. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment every Friday. And our number, 866-440-8466. And Bernie, Ron in Essex Junction, Vermont on the line for you. Hey, Ron, you're live with Bernie Sanders.
Hey, thanks for having me on. Great show.
Thank you.
Bernie, I support you wholeheartedly, and I hope you're our next senator. You were probably the only one in government up here that supported us when we had a trouble with IBM and our pension, and I really appreciate that. But my question is, we always hear national security, and we have to do this for national security purposes, and we have to get off oil for national security purposes. If that's the case, why doesn't the administration say to corporations, you know, you have hundreds, if not thousands, of patents that you own? And I'm sure there's a lot of good ideas there. You know, why doesn't that intellectual property become public domain?
You mean for more fuel-efficient cars, Ron?
What's that?
You mean for why doesn't the government mandate that the corporations create more fuel-efficient cars?
Yeah, why? Well, not only that, but I'm sure I know of one instance where somebody did create a way to get more economy with an invention that was bought out by a corporation, then you never hear of it again. Mm-hmm. I don't know if there are many of those things in the patent office, but why not say, you know, that maybe it's illegal to open them up, but under national security, I'm sure we can open up these patents and see what's there.
Ron, the bottom line is that I think everybody understands that right now we have the technology and we have the ideas to move this country big time away from fossil fuels and into sustainable energy. Right now, just give you one tiny example. Right now, in the state of Vermont this summer and in next winter, there will be an automobile driving around the state. It will be a Toyota Prius that looks like any other car, except it will not have a gas tank in it. It will be run by the electricity generated by the hybrid mechanism as well as hydrogen. No gasoline in this car at all. Nobody, I think, doubts that we right now have the knowledge and the capability to break our dependency on fossil fuel. What we lack is the political will. I mean, you've suggested one idea, but it's sitting there waiting to happen. I was in a General Motors hydrogen fuel cell in Washington. You get in it, it drives like any other car, very quiet, very nice. You ask the guy from GM, when is this going to be on the market? Well, we're not sure, 8 years, 10 years. It's nonsense. We do have a national security problem in terms of our dependency on Middle East oil. We should be moving in terms of a Marshall Plan right now into sustainable energy, and we can do it.
Okay. And Kenny in Baltimore, Maryland. Hey, Kenny.
Hey, Bernie. Hey, Tom. Bernie.
Hey, Kenny.
I loved you on Lou Duff yesterday, man. You hit it. You were straight to the point with them yesterday on
Thank
Lou
you.
Duff. I just want to ask you, Democrats get back in control, House, Senate. What can we do with these trade agreements? Can we walk away from them, or do they really have the handcuffs on us right now?
Okay. All right, two things. You know, I am an independent, not a Democrat, and I think it is absolutely imperative that we take power away from the Republicans in both the House and the Senate. I'm working as hard as I can to do that, and I hope all of our listeners will work as hard as they can, because this country is moving in absolutely the wrong direction in every other issue. Having said that, if the Democrats come in, let's not expect that the day after they come in everything is going to be hunky-dory, that they're going to move in the right direction. We're going to need to put a lot of pressure on those guys as well. In terms of trade agreements, my view and the view of a growing number of members of Congress, including many Republicans, is our current trade policies, NAFTA, Permanent Normal Trade Relations with China, other policies have been an absolute dismal failure. Tom, you will remember that when they were debating NAFTA, what they were saying, well, one of the reasons we want to pass NAFTA, it's going to stop illegal immigration from Mexico because it's going to improve the standard of living of the Mexican people. They won't have to come into the United States. You remember that argument?
Oh, yeah.
Absolute absurd, of course. Quite the contrary. Poverty is increasing in Mexico. Standard of living for many of their people is in decline. The China argument was, oh, we're going to open up China to all kinds of American products. Think of all the jobs we're going to create in America. Obviously nonsensical. We have a $725 billion trade deficit, $200 billion trade deficit with China. Corporation after corporation, manufacturing, white-collar, information technology are moving abroad, hiring people at wages far lower than American workers receive. The question that Kenny asks is, what can we do about it? My view is we have got to move big time to fundamentally change our trade policies so that we make them work for American workers and not just the CEOs of large corporations. Jeff Foe, Tom is a fellow you may know. Jeff Foe used to be with the EPI, a very good progressive economist.
Mm-hmm.
His argument is that what we're seeing right now is a coming together of the elites of countries like the United States, the elites in Mexico, the elites in Canada, the elites in Europe, the elites in China, and all of the elites of the world are working together on these great trade agreements, which are good for the people on top, but time and time again are bad for the middle class and working families of our country and the poor people of the third world. So to answer Kenny's question, I think it is absolutely essential that we reverse our trade policies and that we demand that corporate America start investing in the United States of America, not just in China and other developing countries. Is this an easy thing to do? No, it's not. But to my mind, it should be at the very top of the agenda if the Democrats come back to power. And by the way, there'll be many Republicans, I believe, who are prepared to work with them. We should not be seeing, I mean, here's the bottom line on this whole issue. American workers today are being forced to compete against people in China who make 30, 40 cents an hour, go to jail if they stand up for a union, go to jail if they stand up for democratic rights. That is not, quote unquote, the kind of competition, the level playing field that American workers deserve. So we have a lot of work to do in that area.
Amen, brother. Steve in Warwick, Massachusetts on the line. You're live with Bernie Sanders, Steve.
All right. Hi, Bernie. How you doing?
Hey, Steve.
Thank you for being on all the time. I have a question here and stuff. All right, see how the president said that we're so addicted to oil and everything. Why don't he declare an energy state of emergency and have the government scientists that are already in our employ work towards that end?
Oh, because then you're asking him to really do something rather than coin rhetoric. I mean, the president reads the polls, and what the polls show us is the American people are very worried about our dependence on other countries, especially the Mideast, for oil. They are very worried about global warming. They're worried about air pollution. So it's a good speech to give. The real question, as we've discussed earlier on this program just today, does the president have the guts to stand up to the oil industry to tell them to stop, A, ripping off the American people, and B, can we move forward in a very, very serious way towards sustainable energy? It is sitting there waiting to happen. We can't, the idea, Steve, that we are driving vehicles in the United States today that get worse mileage per gallon than 20 years ago is beyond comprehension. Beyond comprehension. Is the president sympathetic to raising the CAFE standards so that we get in a significant way so that we demand that automobile manufacturers produce cars to give us 40, 50, 60, 70 miles per gallon automobiles? No. Are we making the kind of investments in hybrids that we should be investing? No. Are we looking at hydrogen in the kind of ways that we should be looking? No, we're not. So it's good for the president to give a speech, which sounds fine. It is very different to put his political weight and, in fact, a budget into moving us to sustainable energy.
Charles in Glasgow, Kentucky. You're live with Bernie Sanders.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
One thing we have to address, we have to get on top, and it is priority that we have got to get on top of these crooked voting machines. Diebold and the other systems that we're exporting to countries like Italy, that has to come to a stop. You've got to get this democracy back in the hands of the people of the United States. Secondly, I think we have to get somebody who's not on the payroll back in power. We have to start investigating all this war profiteering and corruption in our system. We need to put some of these people in jail. And that's just for starters. What are we doing? What are we doing to correct those matters?
Okay. In terms of voting machines, I personally am on legislation introduced by Rush Holt from New Jersey, which would, at the very least, require a paper trail for any touchscreen computer machine used for voting in the United States. I think we've got to go further than that. And I think if Americans have any doubts about the accuracy of the voting, we should change the way we're going and get rid of machines that do not provide 100% accuracy and make us comfortable that every vote cast will be accurately counted.
Well said. Congressman Bernie Sanders is with us. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment. Our telephone number, 866-440-8466. It's 45 minutes past the hour. We'll be back with more of your calls right after this. I'm Tom Hartman.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
up in the sky, a man in a plane, Baron von Richthofen was his name. Eggman tried, Eggman died, now the parents together on the countryside.
Welcome back, my friends. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Our Brunch with Bernie segment. Bernie, by the way, this is the anniversary of World War One German flying ace Baron Manfred von Richthofen being shot down today. He was killed.
Who would have known that, Tom, other than you, huh?
Yeah, well, that's the buffer. So, yeah. Anyhow, let's get back to the telephone here. Chris in Burlington, Vermont. You are live with Bernie Sanders. Chris?
I'm for letting me on. Bernie, I just want you to know I voted for you ever since you were running for mayor. And I'd love to watch you drive around Burlington in your old Saturn, not a brand new Bentley. My question was about the V-22 Osprey. And the Senate Appropriations Committee is putting...
Excuse me, Chris. Alex, I'm hearing the Red Baron in my headphones here. Okay, go ahead.
Okay, the funding for the V-22 Osprey, which the Senate Appropriations Committee wants to fund as opposed to funding night goggles and other protective gear for troops who are unfortunately still in Iraq. And although this is not in the House, is there anything that you can do or to try to get them back on track and
yes.
Put the money where it belongs?
Yes, that's a very good question, Chris. There is no question that there is a great deal of waste in the Department of Defense, that we're funding weapon systems that we should not be funding, and that we're not putting money into those areas that we should be funding. The idea that we're not providing all of the protection that we should be to our troops in Iraq is wrong, and the idea that we continue to be putting money into systems which have proven not to be particularly effective, or even worse, that we no longer need now that the Cold War is over. There is a significant part of the military budget. We're talking about many billions of dollars that continue to be spent fighting the Soviet Union rather than focusing on international terrorism. So I think we can save a lot of money and do a lot better job targeting what we are spending into those areas that we really should be.
Thank you. Patsy in Tacoma, Washington. You're live with Bernie Sanders.
Hi there. Saw you on your new job, Jesse. You look great. Hey,
thank you very much.
Bernie, I have a question. I'm wondering if you're familiar with the program that's going on in Sweden with methane. They now have one train that runs on methane. They have 375 buses that run on methane.
Wow.
And they also Volvo is putting out a car that runs on methane.
Wow.
And I'm wondering if you're familiar with that.
No, actually, I wasn't familiar with that. Thank you for informing me and listeners about that.
Yeah, I think it's about time you got a delegation to go to Sweden and see what they're doing. I guess they're the most progressive country in the world and working with alternate forms of energy.
Well, you know, your point is very well taken, is that there are a lot of very exciting developments in sustainable energy taking place all over the world. I was in Denmark some years ago. And they are producing a heck of a lot of electricity in their country through wind.
Yeah, almost 20% of it.
Is that what it is?
Yeah.
I think
17 was the last I heard.
I was in Iceland a couple of years ago, and they are moving very big into geothermal, of course,
yeah.
And into hydrogen technology. What I can tell you is that here, even in the state of Vermont, give you just a story of the potential that is out there. Near the Canadian border, there's a small town called Coventry, Vermont. There is a large landfill there. There is a co-op in Vermont, electric co-op, that is now harnessing the methane gas, apropos methane, from the garbage that is festering there, and is now providing electricity for, I think, 3,000 homes in the state of Vermont from garbage. All right. Think of the potential that exists in terms of landfills all over the United States of America. So it is important to be learning what other countries are doing and taking their examples.
Mm-hmm. Oren in Essex Junction, Vermont. You're live with Bernie Sanders.
Hello.
Hey, Oren.
Oh, hi. I'm sorry. I was listening to what you were saying, Mr. Sanders, and I came from California a few years back up in Yolo County. Their landfill, they had actually done that. They refitted it, plastic lined it.
Taking the methane and using it for electricity?
Yeah, and it was great. And I thought, you know, what a wonderful thing to do because we're just going out in the atmosphere anyway.
That's right. Now, this just should give us an understanding of the potential that exists. Think of all of the landfills in the United States. Think of all of the rotting garbage, and think of the kind of electricity that we can generate in moving that approach.
And I agree with you, and I'd like to say this. I'm willing, and I'm not a rich person, I'm willing to pay $5-6 a gallon for gas, but not to give it to ExxonMobil. I'd be willing to pay it if we would take that money in taxes and make people conserve some and use it to come up with new ways of taking care of ourselves so we're not beholden to another country. I mean, that just, to me, makes sense. But the real reason I called, and I wanted to say this while I had a chance, I wholeheartedly agree with what you're saying about we can't really do anything about what this administration's doing until the November elections, and I understand that. One thing I am not hearing much about, and I don't know how I think we need to be working on taking the press back. I think we need to be, in the meantime,
Orin, let me just toss that. Yeah, let me just toss that to Bernie because we only have about 20 seconds left. Bernie, you're taking the press back.
I don't know how we can work
To make Orin, believe me, Tom and I talked about this issue a whole lot. You're absolutely right. There is not going to be the kind of increase in public consciousness in America until we have a media that allows all points of view to be heard, unless the needs of working people in the middle class are expressed. And you're not going to have that when you have fewer and fewer large multinational media conglomerates owning what we see, hear, and read. This is a huge, huge issue.
Yeah, what's happened to the labor section in the newspaper that I remember from when I was a kid in the 60s? You know, they're gone.
That's right.
Yeah. Bernie Sanders, Congressman Bernie Sanders' website, bernie.org. Check it out. Please check it out. Bernie Sanders, Congressman Bernie Sanders. Bernie, thanks so much for being with us today.
Good to be with you, Tom. Take care.
Always great to have you here. It's the Tom Hartman radio program where our talking points come from Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank. Stick around, my friends. We'll be back after the news at the top of the hour. Roland Menard is going to tell us about the Federal Reserve System, something maybe you didn't know that you didn't know. We'll be right back. 57 minutes past the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
Welcome back, my friends. Our quote for the day from Thomas Jefferson: enlighten the people generally, and tyranny and oppressions of body and mind will vanish like spirits at the dawn of day. We talk about economics on this program a lot, and occasionally refer to the Federal Reserve Bank, this Federal Reserve System, and, you know, how it works, how money is created in the United States. But it seemed like a good plan to get somebody on who's a real expert in this thing. Roland Manarin actually manages about $500 million worth of investment as president of Manarin Investment Counsel Limited, portfolio manager with the Lifetime Achievement Fund. He's a talk show host. He runs a show called Your Money, creator of the Manarin Wealth Building Seminar Series, which he's been presenting since 1977. Roland, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Tom. You're talking about Thomas Jefferson, and I'm thinking Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution says Congress has the right to coin money and regulate the value thereof. As a rookie stockbroker, of course, none of us think about that stuff until we're hit with it in the face. The brokerage firm is telling me to push bonds and annuities, and I'm going, wait a minute, we no longer have an honest money. And hence began my discussions on the Federal Reserve.
Yeah. So what is the Federal Reserve?
Well, actually, Federal Reserve System. It is not federal. There are no reserves. It's not a system. It's actually a cartel of the very people who the system was set up to do away with. It was a very evil get-together of the robber baron, sort of, back in 1913, and they concocted this facade, Federal Reserve System, to make it sound benign. In fact, it has ripped us off of our freedoms and much of our wealth.
How?
Well, When they started, $20, Tom, was a man's labor for a month, and that man had a wife with 13 children at home, and everything was fine.
You're talking 1913.
1913. All right. The very first thing they allowed was what's called fractional reserve banking. When you deposit a dollar in the bank, they said you got to put 1/6 in reserve. This is back then. Smart banker puts the whole dollar in reserve, lends it out 6 times. That's called inflation. So the inflation is a devaluation of the currency. It behooves those closest to the action, i.e. the banks.
So it's the banking system that is inflating our currency, not the Treasury Department. Is that what you're suggesting?
Treasury Department has really nothing to do with it. It's the Federal Reserve System and how they structured everything. So they create inflation through fractional reserve banking by allowing the banks to create money out of the clear blue. When they started, it was 1/6. Now the average bank's reserve is down to 3%, which means you deposit $1,000 in the bank, the banker can turn around and lend it out 33 times, $33,000, and he's in compliance.
I mean, right, so he has created, in effect, $32,000.
Yeah,
$32,000.
Exactly. You keep this up, pretty soon you've doubled the money supply, and guess what happens? Bread doubles, cars doubles, fuel doubles.
So what is M3?
Well, M3 is one of the broader measures of money. It is a powerful tool for guys like me to watch, and guess what? They've done away with it. Now they're hiding what they're doing. They don't want people like me to know what they're doing.
But is M3, I thought M3 was a number that was published by the Treasury Department, not by the Federal Reserve Bank. Am I wrong?
You're wrong.
The Fed publishes that number.
That's right, and they've just done away with it. That's the last act of Greenspan, is to do away with it.
And so, this is a number that basically tracks to what extent banks are creating money out of thin air through fractional reserve banking.
In addition, there's one more way that the Fed rips us off, and that's called monetizing debt. So when the Treasury has to write checks and it's out of money, how do they come up with it? Well, if they borrow it, it's not a problem. You borrow $1 out of the economy, put a dollar back in, you're even. But if they can't borrow the dollars, then they have to create them. And so now they borrow it from the Federal Reserve because they got a magic checkbook. Now all of a sudden you got all kinds of money appearing out of the clear blue.
So if that's the case, why did the Congress have to go back and raise the debt ceiling?
That's why. They keep borrowing money.
Yeah,
the Treasury.
But the Treasury Department is issuing Treasury bonds, which are debt instruments against the United States government.
Yeah.
What does that have to do with the Federal Reserve banking system?
All right. The Treasury runs out of money. Now they need another $100 billion. Where are they going to get it? They can't borrow it anymore.
China comes in and says, we'll loan it to you. Just give us Treasury bills and your IOUs in exchange for it.
That's a smaller part of it. When they can't do that, they have to turn to the Fed. And they say, hey, Fed, we're out of money. The Fed says, print up $100 billion in Treasury bonds and lend them to we'll use them as collateral, and we'll deposit a check to your account. Go write the bills. Pay the bills.
So
that's how they create massive amounts of money.
So the Fed, in other words, is holding a lot of the treasuries that are issued by the federal government.
That's correct.
And to what percentage, what extent?
I don't know, but it's huge.
Huh.
It's not important. The important thing is the money goes out on the street. And so the people listening to us who are saving money, if you're buying a CD or a bond, you have a claim on future paper money.
Right.
I call those instruments of guaranteed confiscation of your buying power.
Because basically the banking system, the way it's set up now, guarantees inflation. And the reason why governments like inflation is because they can spend money in current dollars and pay it off in the future in devalued dollars.
You got it. When we were young, a new Mustang was $2,000. Now it's a good GT is $35,000. It's not a better car.
Now, the first 5 cars I owned, I never paid more than $35 for a car. It was a badge of honor when I was a kid. That was in the 70s.
I beat you. I bought one for $20.
Yeah, well, but I mean, you know, $35 actually, you could buy a decent car back then.
Yeah.
And now it would be probably $350 or maybe $1,000 in its equivalent purchasing power, more or less, from 1968 when
Absolutely. Gold is the messenger.
Now, if that's the case, if gold is the messenger, and gold is, you know, pushing 620 right now, and it was at 290, 280, 290 when Bush came into office. If the increase in the price of gold is really a reflection in the decrease of the value of the dollar, why is it that gold was so low throughout the 80s and 90s?
Alan Greenspan manipulated the system. he and his cronies, in my opinion, this is just my opinion, shorted the dollars. There were more gold, more gold was shorted than existed.
You mean they were buying contracts to sell gold?
Yes.
That didn't exist.
That's correct.
In order to drive down the price of gold in the market because there were so many contracts to sell out there.
That's right. And that's been
and
going
on. And the Fed
on.
Was buying, it was shorting gold?
I don't know about the Fed.
Well, Greenspan ran the Fed.
Well, Greenspan ran the Fed. The people shorting gold were more like the money center banks and hedge funds.
So it's like Greenspan's buddies were shorting gold.
Pretty much, that's the
and,
way I see
and
it.
And now they're going long on gold.
Well, at least they got to cover their short positions, and there's still a huge short position out there. So it's interesting.
So that means if your conspiracy theory is right, and I don't mean that in a negative sense, that means that the price of gold has to continue going up for these guys to make out. Otherwise, they're going to get caught with their pants down, more or less.
Well, Carter tried to manipulate the price of gold. Ford tried to manipulate it. Nixon tried to manipulate it. They just can't. Over the long term, the free market takes over.
So you think gold was at six, as I recall, around 600 when Nixon was president, or maybe it was in the 70s. Whoever was president then, maybe it was Carter. Where is it going to go now? Do you think?
I don't know. I don't know where it's going to go.
Yeah. Well, obviously you're not a mind reader, and a future
history screams at you what gold does. Gold bought you a fine Roman silk tunic and a fine pair of sandals. 100 years ago, bought you a fine suit, a fine pair of shoes. Today, it buys you a medium suit, no shoes. So, based on history, it's still cheap.
Interesting. Interesting. So, we have about 2 minutes left. We're talking with Roland
Manarin.
Manarin, right?
Manarin,
I'm sorry. Roland Manarin, manarin.com, the website. President and founder of Manarin Investment Counsel Limited. Roland, what should we do about this if we have this system that just works to the advantage of the bankers and people in the government and basically screws all the rest of us?
Not much we can do because we don't have a choice. We're stuck with electing one of their two choices. Neither of them are patentable to me. Someday, somewhere, we might pick up a Jefferson, but...
Then knowing about it, what can the average person do to protect their assets and their investments?
They should accumulate ownership positions, common stocks, diversify between maybe 10 mutual funds or more, put 5, 6, 7% of your portfolio into gold mining shares, again through mutual funds, and just keep accumulating, cross your arms, ignore the yo-yo. First thing I told my papa 30 years ago, it's going to yo-yo up a flight of stairs. You're going to lose money 2-3 times per decade. Once in a while, it'll be a big one. Ignore it, you win. And that's exactly what's happened.
So buy real assets. Don't keep your money in the bank as money.
That's correct. And a bond is a claim on money. An annuity is a claim on money.
Interesting. Interesting. Yeah. Roland Manarin, manarin.com, the website. Roland, thanks a lot for talking with us today.
Peace and goodwill. Bye-bye.
Indeed. Fascinating discussion there. It's the place where smart people get their news, the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Drop by our live chat room at tomhartman.com if you'd like and say hi. 16 minutes past the hour. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
My SUV is bigger than yours. I don't mess around when I hit for the store. Got a bigger motor, bigger seats, bigger flow for my big fat feet. Bigger windows so I can see all the tiny little people in front of me. When I need to park, no need to worry. Got bumpers to blow small buildings in a hurry. Environment, don't make me laugh. Give a damn about a tank of gas. My wife wants the keys when she goes to the bank. She says it feels like it's driving in a tank. I guess what I'm getting at, you might say, is bigger is better in the USA.
And welcome back, my friends. 21 minutes past the hour. Earth Day this weekend. Welcome back. Ellen Ratner's with us with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Hey, Ellen.
Well, it looks as if Tony Snow is the main man running, not 100%, but they definitely want somebody TV savvy, is what we are hearing.
So the Bush administration is actually going to start paying somebody from Fox News to shovel this stuff to us rather than just getting it for free.
Well, depends on how you look at it. Yes, I guess you could say it that way. You know, I always back off when you say anything about Fox News Channel, since they're my employer. We have to be honest about that.
That's right. You're one of, well, would you, I don't mean this disparagingly, but do you consider yourself one of their punching bag liberals?
I mean, they've never told me what to say. They've always been very supportive of anything. Anytime I want something brought up, they'll go along with it. If I say, hey, let's talk about this week, they've always been very cool to me. So, I don't know. What can I say?
Yeah.
They've been great.
That's interesting. Well, I'm glad you're having that experience with them.
I mean, and I've worked for them for 9 years. So, I mean, they do have a conservative editorial point of view. But, hey, I have a little liberal editorial point of view. What can I say? Anyway, a few other things. It looks as if Josh Bolton is having some backdoor meetings, and they're trying to get Karl Rove, Ken Melman, and all those folks to try and get there to be a much more together deal, so to speak, on all of this. In terms of the election. So that is definitely coming back to get at them.
The White House is trying to get their act together for the November election.
They need to win those 2006 elections, and according to my White House sources, they see the numbers, and it's not very pretty.
In fact, I understand that Harriet Myers might even get bounced because, she's Bush's lawyer,
well,
and they're concerned about indictments against Bush.
One of the most interesting things is that yesterday when they were having this briefing with the National Security Council, they have those seats and they all face in the front in the press room. And I was sitting in Helen's seat and Wendy Wang was in back. And Wendy had a much better view of there's like four seats that sit on the side where the staffers sit.
Mm-hmm.
And one guy was redoing his resume.
Wow.
During this whole thing.
During the meeting with the president.
Well, no, this was the briefing that we had in the press room.
Oh, I see.
So what I'm saying is when the national security staff is coming in, they're going to do a pretty clean sweep, I think.
Oh, man. Oh,
you're going to see a lot of people go. We're also hearing that they're not going to announce a new press guy possibly before the White House Correspondents' Dinner.
Hmm. And when is that?
That is next Saturday, a week from tomorrow.
So it might be a week and a half that Scotty is still in his job.
He'll be in his job for 2 or 3 weeks because there will be a transition.
Yeah, he looked like he was going to cry when he was announcing his resignation. I understand he very clearly was pushed out.
I think he was pushed out, but I'll tell you something. I saw him yesterday, and he was a happy camper. So he must be. He must have decided, move on and make money.
Well, they've probably given him a golden parachute.
Well, they can't give him a golden parachute, actually. The only parachute they could do is get him a job somewhere else.
Well, that's what I meant. They'll grease the skids into something that he's very happy with. Thank you very much.
That's right. And he's I've never seen Scott look happier. And I got to, he may be the mouthpiece of the evil policies, but the nicest guy you can possibly imagine on the planet.
Yeah, I've heard that he's actually, just as a person.
He'd take time with interns. He was just a great guy.
Yeah, and therefore the Bush administration has to get rid of him.
Right. Well, I'll tell you, I know Tony Snow very well, and Tony is also a very nice human being. Has not been affected by the Washington sort of spin. I mean, he is very conservative politics. That's who Tony is through and through. But in terms of just a sort of a decent human being, very nice, tries to give his time to charity, that kind of stuff, good guy. But again, politics are dreadful.
Yeah, interesting to get your take on that. We have just a minute left, Ellen. At the top of Think Progress right now, a whole documentation of how the Bush administration has started, or at least the right-wing spin machine, Charles Krauthammer, et cetera, has started swift-boating these seven generals who have come out against Rumsfeld.
Oh, right. And what's also happening is they are being swift-boated, and this General Batista, depending on how you pronounce his name, he has basically said that he has gotten much more positive feedback that far exceeds any negative feedback, he said. He said he's getting some negative, too, and he said some of it was negative, but he's getting a lot of positive feedback from what those generals did.
From his peers in the military.
That's right.
That's very interesting. So do you think that the swift-boat attempts on them are going to be successful? I mean, they're going to try and drag this stuff into the election and say that these guys are traitors.
It's unclear. I mean, obviously, we've already heard that kind of thing, And one of the things I heard was, well, I mean, these guys, why didn't they say it when they're in uniform? Well, you can be in big trouble if you say stuff when you're in uniform.
Right, yeah, no, the military has
but
has to be.
But that's what the right wing is spinning.
Yeah, there you go. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service. Thank you, Ellen.
Thank you.
Great talking with you. TalkRadioNews.com, their website. It's 27 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Harbin.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
It's my life and I do what I want. It's my mind and I think what I want. Show me I'm wrong. Hurt me sometimes. But someday I'll teach you to be fine.
And welcome back. Defending America from the conservative weapons of mass deception. Tom Hartman here with you. 25 minutes before the hour, or will be shortly. Over at foxhounds.us, the group that, you know, we watch Fox, so you don't have to, there's a really, really good analysis there posted by Judy, a member of their staff, I believe, and titled, Why Natalie Holloway is Lucky She's Not Around to Make Accusations. Now, you know, why would a disappeared and presumably dead woman be lucky? Judy points out that there is a correlation, a very specific and very this is just a brilliant analysis, by the way. This is one of those things where when I first read this, it was like I knew everything that was in here and I had never put it together in my own head. And it's stuff that we have talked about on this program that I've shared with you. And yet, you know, Judy, you know, 2 + 2 = 4. Bingo. The association between the Duke lacrosse team rape and Natalie Holloway. Why are these kinds of stories flogged to death on Fox News and in other conservative media? You know, Joe Scarborough, MSNBC, Rita Crosby. Why do the conservative media flog stories like Natalie Holloway and the Duke lacrosse gang rape and not look at, you know, serious news stories? It has to do with a political agenda, and this has to do with psychology at a really subtle level. This is really important stuff. Pay careful attention. Judy notes, I'm just going to share in part, you know, what she wrote here, and you know, I'll toss in a little commentary of my own from time to time, but she says it so tight and so elegantly. She says, everything on Fox News has a political agenda, even coverage of missing white women, which we all know far exceeds the coverage of missing people of any other gender, race, or network on this network. The Natalie Holloway disappearance and the alleged gang rape of a woman by members of the Duke lacrosse team both represent that. How? Well, she says, Fox News editors and reporters subscribe to a worldview in which men rule, what George Lakoff calls the strict father paradigm. The father is the boss in the family, and by extension, George Bush is the boss of the country and of the world. Family members are subject to the strict father's severe discipline, which they need in order to learn how to survive in the world. Besides meeting out discipline, the father's job is to protect the family members from the dangerous world outside. Now, here's how it works. As often as the media can cause us to flip into the strict father way of thinking, or of feeling, really, because we're talking about stuff that is functionally subliminal, that is below the level of consciousness, the more often they can flip us into those kind of feelings or worldviews, the more they win. Because that is the worldview that George Bush is putting forward. Progressives, on the other hand, and traditionally Americans, the traditional American worldview is to see the nation as a family made up of nurturing parents who have equality and among themselves, you know, father and mother, and equal responsibility for raising their children in a loving environment that stresses empathy and caring over strict discipline. As Judy points out over at foxhounds.us, when the strict father frame is active in viewers, George Bush and the conservatives win. It is Fox News' job to keep that strict father frame active in its viewers' minds at all times. Within this worldview, Fox News recognizes only two kinds of women. Now, I would say this is true of everybody who subscribes to this strict father worldview, whether it's Jerry Falwell or Ralph Reed or George W. Bush. I mean, you know, just right across the board, the hard right conservatives in the Catholic Church and other Protestant denominations, hard right conservatives in Islam, in Judaism, right across the board, all religions, they basically only recognize two kinds of women. Victims, a.k.a. Natalie Holloway, and what Judy describes as sexual deviants slash whores. Thus, we had Rush Limbaugh last week calling the woman who was raped, or is alleging that she was raped by these Duke lacrosse players, calling her a hoe. Because a woman can't be an equal. See, as soon as, in their mind, as soon as you start talking in terms of compassion, you're activating the nurturing parent frame. And conservatives want to keep us as far away from that nurturing parent frame as possible, because the way that they maintain political power and control is by activating the strict father frame. Oh, Daddy, protect us from the world. It's dangerous.
I'm the decider. I know what's best. I'll take care of you.
So Fox News and conservatives in general only recognize these two kinds of women, victims and sexual deviants slash whores. And therefore, Natalie Holloway is right now in the victim category. Now, you see, in both cases, they're subservient in the hierarchy, in the moral and power hierarchy to men, particularly to white men. So Judy says, suppose Natalie Holloway had been able to escape her attackers that night and go to the police with her story of what happened. Then she would have slipped from the category of victim to sexual deviant, the same Fox News category that encompasses the alleged victim in the Duke lacrosse gang rape case, the female teachers who have sex with their students, another favorite theme of Fox News, the most progressive of women politicians, such as Hillary Clinton and Dianne Feinstein, who are characterized by Fox and other conservatives as sexual deviants slash whores. Why would Holloway have to have switched categories? Because her going to the police would necessarily have entailed making accusations against males. And unless those males are non-white, by making an accusation against a male, Natalie Holloway would have been challenging the authority of the strict father figure, which is the touchstone of so much conservative thinking, writes Judy. Strict father figures are to be obeyed, not challenged, writes Judy over at foxsound.us. Once a woman, even a likely victim such as Natalie Holloway, challenges that authority, they must be destroyed through character assassination, and the targets of her accusations must be defended at all costs because they are society's supreme authority figures, privileged white males. Because Holloway is not around to make allegations, she can safely remain in the victim category. She's not challenging white male authority, thus she's a safe victim. If she were alive and making allegations of a horrific experience at the hands of white male attackers on the beach that night, Fox News would drop her. In fact, Judy writes, Fox News would drop her like a whore with syphilis. Natalie Holloway would become the issue to a much greater extent than she has so far. What her sexual history was, what she told police, inconsistencies in her story, what kind of woman goes to the beach with guys she doesn't know, on and on and on, and the white male suspects would be characterized as the victims. Which brings us back, Judy writes, to Fox News' political agenda. Strong, progressive women fall into the sexual deviant category, not because of their sexual activity necessarily, but because of the threat they pose to the strict father paradigm. They are sexual deviants because they don't fit into the conservative frame of a family where the father rules without challenge. They must be attacked and destroyed unmercifully because every right-wing male knows that if Hillary Clinton is ever elected president, his authority within his own family is at risk, or so he fears. Judy notes the challenge for progressives, according to Lakoff, is to avoid activating that strict father paradigm in American voters at all costs. In the case of a woman who cries rape, that means focusing on caring and compassion for the victim in hopes of activating the nurturing parent frame that exists in Americans' psyches and deactivating that strict parent frame. Now, I would take it even a step beyond that. I would say that Hillary Clinton, one good friend of mine who has talked with Hillary Clinton in private, and Hillary made a joke to her about gays, her public position, I'm sure, is probably supportive of gay rights. But, you know, I don't think that she, well, actually, I can't speak on behalf of Hillary Clinton, so I'm not going to try to. But here's what Hillary Clinton has in common with gay women, and for that matter, gay men, is that they all represent a challenge to white male heterosexual authority. Because the only categories that there are in this, in the conservative mind, in the conservative worldview, the only categories there are white males in charge, fathers who are protecting us from the dangerous world, and everybody else subservient, which would be, you know, women who are women or children, basically. And where gays challenge that, the reason why conservatives are so terrified of gays is because a gay man is neither strict father. Well, he's not a strict father, and yet at the same time, he's male. And so that busts up their frame. So they're intimidated by gay men. And a gay woman is not a strict father, and she's not a subservient woman. So I would suggest that some of our female politicians who are you know, considering their role in all this, Dianne Feinstein, Hillary Clinton, Barbara Boxer, once they understand that the conservatives have to cast them in this role of either victim or whore, basically, then unless they can activate in the minds of their constituents, the potential voters, unless they can activate the we're all in this together frame, which Hillary tried to do once by writing a book, It Takes a Family, or it takes a village, rather, to you know, that was the frame, the nurturing parent frame. Unless they can successfully activate that frame, they're going to be the victims of right-wing character assassinations. And that's the challenge for female politicians and progressives, I'd say, in general. I think this is a fascinating insight into why Fox News and all the other right-wing media are flogging this Natalie Holloway and the Duke Lacrosse gang rape thing, and also what kind of challenge that means for progressives. 45 minutes past.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Oh, Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood.
And welcome back, my friends.
If I see Edgy, I want you to know that I never meet to take it out on you.
Helping you win the water cooler wars. Tom Hartman here with you. 50 minutes past the hour, coming up on 9 minutes before the hour. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Janice in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Janice, welcome to the program, and thank you for listening to WPTT.
Well, thank you, Tom. It's great listening to you. But what you just read, oh, my gosh, I agree with you. The light went on because all of a sudden I saw myself, many times, you know, when you're talking to other parents and whatever, I'll say things about myself like, well, I'm such a progressive liberal type person, but yet I do have rules for my children. I am kind of strict in a way, as if it's an oxymoron.
No, it's not. I mean,
not, exactly.
Yeah, yeah. Louise and I were I don't want to say very strict with our kids because that has varied meanings. I mean, we never beat kids or anything like that. But
yeah,
we
would
say you can't play with that person because we think they're a bad influence. You can with this person. I mean, you know, we were active, let's say, parents, and yet we're very progressive because we felt that that was part of nurturing, not that that was part of controlling.
Right. Exactly. And also, I wanted to say to you, but sometimes I do get my nerve up to listen to Sean Hannity after you, just to hear what he's saying.
Sure.
Do you know that he's actually telling people that it was him and right-wing radio that elected George Bush because they told their listeners to vote for him?
Right, which is the strict father model. You know?
Exactly.
That he will tell us how we should behave. He will protect us from the world. Yeah, it's really remarkable. George Lakoff writes about this in his book, Don't Think of an Elephant. And he actually credits a graduate student of his who shared it with him first. But really, this is something that goes back, you know, 30 years or more. In fact, it seems like Maslow was talking about this stuff. I mean, this is not new, but putting it in the context of understanding conservative politics is relatively new, and I think it's brilliant.
Yes. Thank you, Janice,
thanks for the call.
Okay.
Great to hear from you. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Julie in Eureka, California. Hey, Julie.
Well, hi, Tom. I hear this one message coming through all of your program today, and I don't know if it's because it's something that's really happening in my life right now, but it's about that concept of those who seek power over versus those who seek the power that comes from within, the personal power of mutual appreciation and building of people's strengths. And
domination versus cooperation.
Correct. And that seems to be the basic conflict that's happening and that we're all struggling with, and that you buy into the idea that the politicians are in a role of helping the people, the common people, to achieve independence and to become enlightened or to have what they want out of life, and that's what their role is. That's what we've elected them for. That's what we've put them there for. And yet they really are seeking to have power over us in all these ways, in controlling our ability to have transportation that's reliable and cheap and doesn't harm our world, in order to be able to raise our children without pesticides and threats to their health that we're not even allowed to know about. It seems to me like it's just, I heard it when you were talking about the bankers and the banking guilds that are controlling global economic interests, and it just feels to me like it's like the basic conflict in the world today is that of those who seek power over with those who are seeking power from mutual compatibility and building of each other's strengths.
I agree with you. In fact, I wrote a book about it called The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight.
I'm reading it right now.
Oh, great. Well, you know, the book is theoretically about the end of oil, but it's really about the difference between what Dan Quinn calls, you know, taker and leaver cultures, or dominator and cooperator cultures, or what I refer to as older and younger cultures.
Yes. I read it. I guess part of why I'm calling you today is because I'm feeling that you've got my head spinning in that way, and I'm hearing it in everything.
Well,
and I wanted to just shout it out to everybody. There's a pattern here. Look at it. It's important.
There you go. Well said. Julie, thank you very much.
Thank you, Tom.
Great to hear from you, and thank you for calling. And thanks for listening on KGOE there in Eureka. In fact, Dave, listening on KGOE in Eureka, is on the line. Hey, Dave, what's up?
There you go. Well said. Julie, thank you very much.
Dave? Oh, I'm going to put you on hold. Dave will come back to you. Barbara in Bellingham, Washington. Hey, Barbara.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I was interested in whether or not you had any information about the latest fraud perpetrated on us poor taxpayers, that being the American Embassy in Baghdad. It is supposed to be completely self-contained. They've drilled their own water wells. They've made their own power plant. It's costing millions and billions.
It's $1 billion, $1,000 million.
And nobody has shown an exterior photograph of it. I want to see the exterior, and it's supposed to be as big as a small country.
Yeah, it's a city within a city. It's going to be almost the size of Liechtenstein, I guess. And
why
yes.
Are they ashamed of it?
Good question. It is the only project in Iraq right now which is on budget and on schedule.
And
under
the
budget, on schedule.
Can't get clean drinking water.
That's right. But this is a community that will house over 15,000 people. The embassy itself will employ over 1,000 people. It'll be the largest U.S. embassy in the world.
Yes.
And it is on time, on target, and under budget.
Why?
Although there's $8 billion missing in Iraq, it may be that part of that has something to do with why it's under budget.
Why do you think the corporate media won't cover this?
Because the Bush administration won't give them access to it, and the corporate media basically are lazy and they go where they're told. So that's
another fraud.
Yeah, well, or at least another, you know, what it does, Barbara, is it demonstrates, I think, you know, fairly clearly that the Bush administration's agenda in Iraq really goes back in some ways to that neocon notion that we have to have a giant footprint in the Middle East, because our strategic interests lie with oil, because you can't make war without oil, and we're all about making war, or at least the neocons are all about making war. That's why Bush wants to threaten Iran with war rather than trying to talk to them. It's why he's threatening North Korea with war rather than talking to them. He doesn't know how to talk to people. He subscribes to the strict father model. The only tool he has is a stick. It's 57 minutes past the hour. The Tom Hartman Program.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back for your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity, the third hour of the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Glad to have you with us. Congressman John Conyers is on the line, his website, johnconyers.com. Congressman Conyers, one of my heroes, Congressman from Michigan. Sir, thank you very much for being with us today.
Tom Hartman, it's a pleasure to be on your show whenever I can.
And it's always great to have you here, sir. I understand you have just introduced a new piece of legislation on the issue of bankruptcy.
Yes. Well, what we're trying to do is stop this open door to corporations, Tom, that every time they want to renegotiate a contract, they threaten that they're going to bankruptcy court and throw out the union agreement and everything else with it. And guess what? Frequently, the bankruptcy judges give the corporations what they want. But they finally, Delphi bid us in, and so members of Congress are now reacting.
Yeah.
You know, Delphi wanted to cancel labor agreements, slash the hourly workforce by 75%, and cut hourly wages from $27 to $16.50, and then at the same time reward their executives with millions of dollars in salary and stock option benefits. And so Evan Bayh of Indiana, a Democrat, a senator, and I've introduced the Fair Accountability Act, which would close some of the loopholes that allow folks like Delphi to reward their executives while they slash the wages and benefits of working families. And so we're saying that the bankruptcy judges now, when the companies come in pleading that they're losing money and they can't operate under the collective bargaining agreement, we're saying that we've got to now take into consideration their entire corporate benefits and profits overseas as well as here.
Hmm.
Many of the companies are talking about the fact they're losing money in the U.S., but many of them are highly profitable outside of the U.S., and so we want all of that taken into consideration. And we want the bankruptcy court to stop being an easy way to bust collective bargaining agreements between hardworking employees and executives that merely want to benefit themselves.
Yeah, it's really amazing that, for example, the Sago Mines, where these folks died in West Virginia a while ago, on their website, they essentially brag about the fact that through a previous bankruptcy, they were able to shed their union. And whereas all the miners in Canada are unionized and all the mines in Canada have safe rooms where miners can go in the event of an accident.
Of course. Well, this kind of judicial leniency has got to be revisited. I'm still amazed that we could leave a system that has allowed at least our industries to be organized, and now we allow people to come back after a couple years and say, we can't do this anymore. It'll put us out of business.
Yeah.
Well,
and
I don't believe, frankly, that the corporate lawyers are so slow-witted that the labor lawyers trick them into concessions that are going to get them in trouble. I mean, look, they're good lawyers on both sides. They both give a little. They both take a little. But to say that one side can then come in and plead poverty and kick out the contract, sometimes, which has been negotiated for months and months, and say that we're going to go bankrupt if you don't give us another chance.
Right.
It's an abuse of bankruptcy, and it's got to stop. And that's why I'm on the House Judiciary Committee as the senior member.
Yes.
Is that we've got to stop these kinds of practices that only harm the working people and their family, but in the end, they harm the corporation as well. If you can't sell your product to your workers, it's just a matter of time before you're going to go out of business anyway.
Yeah, well said. I think it's so ironic that this last round of bankruptcy so-called reform that the Republicans pushed through the House and Senate last year basically made it much, much
terrible.
Harder. Yeah, it made it much harder,
terrible.
Harder for the average person to declare bankruptcy, and yet Donald Trump could use it to bail himself out in Las Vegas.
Well, you know, it was the credit card companies that have been pushing that bill to make it harder on the average working people who may need bankruptcy, and they failed for 10 years, and finally last year they succeeded. And it was quite embarrassing to me how many Democratic colleagues of mine went along with the scheme.
Yeah, well, I think a lot of money was being passed out, Congressman John Conyers. It's just a rough one. We're talking with Congressman John Conyers of Michigan. His website, johnconyers.com. And Congressman Conyers, you are also, of course, the author of this House resolution to investigate the potential.
House Resolution 635, which creates a select committee to examine all of the things that came out in our six-month staff study about what abuses of power that have come out of the administration, starting with warrantless wiretaps on American soil. And, you know, I'm amazed by the media, some of them, who say that we've got to spy on Al-Qaeda. Well, you don't have to tell me that. It's the spying on American citizens who haven't done a thing that gets me. And then we find out that a lot of companies have been furnishing the data voluntarily in stacks and stacks, so that there are hundreds of thousands of people who've been caught up in this, and we want to find out why. And we think that the president is clearly abusing his power. As a matter of fact, Lawrence Tribe, one of the great constitutional scholars, said that here's a president who clearly thinks that he is above the law. If you can't find it in the law or the Constitution, the power doesn't exist. It doesn't. You don't have suspended powers of the president hanging out there somewhere. And then, of course, you add on the fact that we're violating the Geneva Accords against torture, and we, of all people, whose principles and democratic senses of fairness require people to look and emulate us, what are they thinking that we don't want to honor the requirement that enemy combatants, whether we capture them or whether our men and women are captured by the enemy, would not be accorded the fullest appreciation of conventions that prevent torture, inhumane treatment, or brutality of any way of people who are captured by the other side.
Yeah,
and then, of course, the final thing, Tom, is the whole question of how we got into the war in Iraq and whether it was being planned all the time that the White House was telling us that this was something that they were weighing very carefully. And we have a lot of evidence that says that, that there was planning in advance. And now we have polls saying that if the president lied to us about how we got into this misguided, godforsaken war in Iraq, that he should be impeached. And so we're putting all that together to say we want to show that there is a record, a pattern of practice that is so unusual, that is so out of the way, that is in violation to everything that this country stands for, that we want to have a hearing. And a hearing with a select committee that has the same number of Democrats, the same number of Republicans. The vice chairman would have the power of subpoena to, and we could get to the bottom of it. It does not start impeachment.
And people can learn more about it at johnconyers.com and support
exactly.
you in your efforts. Sir, thanks so much for being with us, Congressman John Conyers.
Tom Hartman, have a great weekend, and for all your listeners, you're listening to one of the best radio programs in the nation.
Thank you, sir.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Friends, the Tom Hartman radio program where reason is our lifestyle choice. And, pardon me, just got distracted there. Welcome back. And I just want to wrap up some stuff that we've, you know, covered in the past here. For example, yesterday we were talking about how the folks from, actually, I believe it was a caller who brought it up. The folks from the Westboro or Westover Baptist Church, Fred Phelps and family, the, quote, God hates fags, quote, end quote, group, they just got hit with some sort of a legal process that the military is now using to prevent them from protesting at the funerals of soldiers who died in Iraq. And what they had been doing is they've been marching around saying that these people died because God is punishing America because we condone homosexuality, right? And that's why our soldiers are dying in Iraq. And so they're, you know, God hates fags thing. I mean, I remember living in Montpelier, Vermont. Louise and I moved into Montpelier maybe, 6 years ago now, I guess, 7 years ago. And we were just a four-block walk from the state capitol. And it was right around the time that Howard Dean was moving through the House and Senate in Vermont legislation to comply with a Supreme Court ruling that allowed for civil unions in that state. And sure enough, Fred Phelps and his little Baptist church bunch were out there every day holding up their signs, their God hates fags signs. Well, an alert listener, Cheryl, thank you, Cheryl, for this, an alert listener sent to me a little bit of information that I had somehow missed. And, you know, I thought I knew about this stuff, but I somehow missed this. She points out that it's not that God hates fags. It's that God hates figs. Fred Phelps and his family are the victims of a typographical error. And, in fact, there's proof for this in the Bible. In Matthew 21, 18 through 20, for example. Just quoting from the Bible here. Now in the morning, as he returned into the city, he hungered. He's talking about Jesus. And when he saw a fig tree on the way, he came onto it and found nothing thereon but leaves only, and said to it, "Let no fruit grow on thee henceforth forever." And presently the fig tree withered away. So Jesus hated figs. And then in Jeremiah, this is Jeremiah 29:17. Thus saith the Lord of hosts, "Behold, I will send upon them the sword, the famine, and the pestilence, and will make them like vile figs that cannot be eaten, and they are so evil." And then Mark 11, 12 through 24. On the morrow, when they were come to Bethany, Jesus was hungry, and seeing a fig tree far off, having leaves, he said, he came, if haply he might find anything on. And when he came to it, he found nothing but leaves, for the time of the figs was not yet. And Jesus said unto it, "No man might eat the fruit of that forever after." And and his disciples heard it. That from Mark 11:12. So here we have biblical proof that it isn't that God hates fags. It's that God hates figs. And the folks over at the Westboro Baptist Church, they just got it wrong. And it's, you know, it's really a tragedy, you know, that they got it so right. Here's another one. This from Psalm 78:47. Right, this is David, King David, writing. He destroyed their vines with hail and their sycamore figs with sleet. Eat a fig, go to hell, right? And so this, by the way, there's a website devoted to this called GodHatesFigs.com. So the next time somebody is quoting to you about Fred Phelps and the Westboro Baptist Church or whatever it is, just send them to GodHatesFigs.com and let them figure out what's really going on here. Indeed. A respectful W hears a who. Now, this was fascinating. Now, George W. Bush brought in Hu Jintao and gave him a state visit, not a high honor, not the official visit that Bill Clinton gave his predecessor, Jiang Zemin, is granted the honor of a state visit, an official state visit. Excuse me, he didn't get a state visit. He got a respectful visit here. And who not so happy about that? But here's an interesting question. A reporter asked when China will be allowed to be a democracy. This from today's New York Post. When will China be allowed to be a democracy? And who said, the dictator of communist China, he said, I don't know. What do you mean by a democracy? He added that he only favors the orderly participation of Chinese citizens. So interesting to see. You know, it's key issues that were on the table. China's currency. Basically, he said to Bush, we'll think about it. In fact, actually, this is interesting. National Security Advisor Stephen Hadley, the guy who had Condi Rice's job when she dropped the ball and 9/11 happened, and allowed 9/11 to happen. He says that the president privately asked Hu to release six specific people now jailed in China. And who might be willing to act on three of them. He said, in fact, Hadley told CNN, and I quote, there are six things we asked them to do. They've indicated there are about three of them that they are prepared to do after this visit. We're not going to be able to talk about them at this point. Then he said, obviously, when the Chinese reform, say what? We will make it very clear that these are contributions to the developing dialogue on human rights. All right. When the Chinese reform... And then, of course, the Falun Gong protester got hustled off, and who is going, oh, yes, they do it the same as we do. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back, my friends. 34 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, the pill that will help you escape the matrix. Speaking of pills, so today the anniversary of the Columbine killings, and they have apparently caught some kids who were thinking of repeating this, which raises the question, were those kids also on psychoactive drugs? On SSRIs like Luvox that Harris was on, for example, and that at least one lawsuit apparently is alleging might have had something to do with this. Now, obviously, this is the kind of thing that, like, the Church of Scientology and whatnot, you know, jumps on because they're anti-psychiatric medication. But on the other hand, there have been a startling number of these kids involved in these kind of incidents who were on mind-altering drugs. And so odds are we'll never find out because minors are generally protected, at least while they're alive, you know, their privacy rights. But it's an interesting question to ask. And so I just raise it. By the way, our toll-free number, 866-440-8466, the last half hour of our program here on a Friday afternoon. I got an email from a listener. I put people's names out on the air. And the we're talking about the gas war, and the listener says, I thought profits created jobs, paychecks, and companies. He says, suddenly in a free enterprise country, you are against profit? And there's a fundamental flaw in that logic. No, I'm not opposed to profit. As somebody who has run a number of businesses in my life, I'm all in favor of profit. But what we have to understand is what profit is. Profits don't create jobs, paychecks, or companies. They allow them to continue to exist, but it's also possible for a company to exist without profits. You can't exist with losses very long, but you can operate at a break even for years and years and years. And in fact, the vast majority of American companies do just that to avoid paying taxes. They convert any money that would have been profit either into investments in the company or into paychecks for their senior officers. And the vast majority of companies in America are small businesses, and the owners simply pay themselves at the end of the year. So the company doesn't have to get taxed on it, and, you know, they just pay personal income tax on it. What profits create are dividends. Profits create the ability to slosh that profit off. What creates jobs is not profits. What creates jobs is demand. And Americans have lost track of this. I mean, this is stuff that was like Econ 101. This is stuff that any high school kid could have told you in the 1920s, in the 1930s, in the 1940s, the 50s, the 60s, the 70s. And since Ronald Reagan, we have two generations now, nearly. I mean, a generation is 19 years, according to Thomas Jefferson. Demographically, I guess a generation is considered 20 years. We have, you know, pushing two generations now who believe that profits create jobs. They don't. Demand creates jobs. So Bush's claim that by having a tax cut that's going to increase profits for corporations, or that's going to increase the net after taxes for millionaires and billionaires, that's going to create jobs. No. Somebody gives me $1 million, I'm not going to say, hey, gee, I think I'll hire somebody. The reason that people start businesses, and I can, you know, speaking again from personal experience, every business I've started is because I saw an opportunity. Back in the 1980s, there were, you know, people were building computers from scratch. This was back when TRS-80s were out, the Radio Shack, TRS-80 Model 3 came out. And there was concern, and a widespread concern, that the picture tubes that were being used in the computers were the older, cheaper versions of TV-type picture tubes, which have relatively high X-ray emission levels. That is, you can measure the radiation from these things a foot away from them. Now, you get 10 feet away from them, you can't measure the radiation, because radiation decays according to what's called the reciprocal of the square law. In other words, it drops off logarithmically as distance increases linearly. So, you know, you get 1 foot away and you got a certain amount of radiation. You get 2 feet away and you have 1/10 as much radiation. You get, you know, 3 feet away, you've got 1/10 again as much. And so you've got this very, you know, so you get 5 feet away from a computer monitor, there's no radiation. But at 2 or 3 feet where people sit and read computers, even though, you know, that wasn't a concern with TVs, it was a concern with computers. And there was a lot of writing about this, a lot of discussion about it. So I got the bright idea. I contacted a guy that I knew in Georgia who owned a company that made picture tubes. And I said, can you make a picture tube? It's got more lead in the glass. And he said, yeah, we already make them. We make them for the government. And the reason that the government wanted them was so that, you know, it was like the CIA or something. It was like they didn't want people to be able to sit across the street with a machine and read the radiation coming out of it. And so I said, great, you know, let me buy some of these things from you at wholesale. And they, you know, we bought these picture tubes at wholesale for $25-$30, something like that. Took out a full-page ad in Byte magazine in 1984. Jerry, my friend Jerry Schneiderman, and I started this company called Langley St. Clair Instrumentation Systems, and we sold them at retail for $100, and, you know, an ad in Byte magazine, and it paid. The ad cost us a couple $1,000s, and we had to pack up. You know, we had 5 employees at one point. And we were just selling picture tubes. We just, you know, we did it for a couple of years, and then the market changed. Everybody figured out that there was a demand for this, and computer manufacturers started making low radiation tubes. We came out with the screen shields. We were importing them from Japan because nobody in the United States was making this nickel plated fabric. Put them on the cover on, you know, that you could put over the front of your computer that both reduced glare and stopped radiation. And we started an industry, and we made some good money on it. But we were doing that because there was a demand for it. We could see that people wanted to buy this. We didn't do that because somebody came to me and said, here's $1 million. In fact, we started the company with my credit card. We put the first order of picture tubes from Ron Ordway's picture tube company I'm forgetting the name of it now, outside of Atlanta. I remember the name of the guy who ran it. We put the first order of picture tubes, which was a couple $1,000, and the first ad in Byte magazine on my American Express card. I mean, we started this company with debt. We didn't start it with profits. And I would suggest to you that that's how most companies in America, at least most small businesses, start. And then they grow from there. Louise and I started a travel agency in Atlanta in 1984. And we did that because we saw the travel industry was deregulated. Nobody was serving the needs of small and medium-sized businesses. And so we had we would have these monthly, you know, parties where we would invite people. We'd give away a free ticket, a free trip someplace. We started a frequent flyer program. It got us on the front page of the Wall Street Journal. That company grew from nothing to $6 million in annual sales in 3 years when we sold it. Last year, I sold that company in 86. Last year, they did $24 million in business. That's a quarter of $1 billion since we started it that company has done, contributed to the economy. We started that company with money on our credit card. I mean, profits don't create jobs. Demand creates jobs, and good ideas create jobs and create businesses. And so, you know, it's just this whole idea of trickle-down economics. I mean, we have to puncture this balloon. We've got to wake people up to this stuff. Okay, moving along on this. There's a bunch of other things that I wanted to just cover here before we end up our week. The FBI, going back to the frame that we were talking about a couple hours ago about how, you know, the Bushies have this whole frame of the critical father or the harsh father, the judgmental father role as the protective father, frankly, role as the conservative mindset, as opposed to the nurturing parents, which is the liberal mindset or the traditional American mindset, frankly, and certainly the European mindset. The FBI is now looking for a few good agents. They have posted help wanted ads. Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez and Robert Mueller, the director of the FBI, described as one of their top priorities, looking for people to bust purveyors of pornography. Not child pornography. We're talking normal garden variety, consenting adults watching consenting adults pornography. One FBI agent says, I guess this means we've won the war on terror. We must not need any more resources for espionage. Among friends and trusted colleagues, this from the Washington Post today, among friends and trusted colleagues, a national security analyst said, it's a running joke for us. A few of the printable samples, and these are from people inside the FBI. Things I don't want on my resume, volume 4, that they worked on the porn squad, right? I already gave at home. Honestly, most of the guys would have to recuse themselves. These are people inside the FBI making these, you know, comments and jokes about it. But, notes the Washington Post, Christian conservatives, long skeptical of Alberto Gonzalez, greeted the pornography initiative with what the Family Research Council called a growing sense of confidence in our new attorney general. Well, that didn't go over so well. That was from Tuesday's paper. That didn't go over so well. So today, Alberto Gonzalez comes out and says that he's been watching child porn. And he describes it extremely graphically. In fact, so graphically, frankly, I don't want to quote the attorney general. And it brings us back. It reminds me of Ed Meese. Ed Meese was he created this Meese Commission on Pornography, and he came out and announced to the nation that he and his little group on the commission, these five or six men, had watched over 800 hours of pornography, and they were convinced that watching pornography destroys people's minds. And the rest of us in America were sitting around going, then Ed, why don't you check yourself into a hospital? And so Gonzalez trying to resurrect his anti-porn initiative by conflating normal, in quotes, at least legal pornography with kiddie porn. And obviously there's no connection between the two, but Gonzalez out there pushing this thing. It's more of the harsh father frame. Let's activate this thing. Let's make people afraid. Let's make people concerned. Let's make people worried. And that now, speaking of afraid, concerned, and worried, I have to share with you what John Dean, the former lawyer for Richard Nixon, the former White House counsel, had the job that Alberto Gonzalez used to have, what he wrote about in FindLaw this week about how George Bush is a dangerous president and why. 45 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
There is a house in yours. They cool the rising sun. And it's been the ruin of many a war. In God, I know I'm one.
And welcome back. 9 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. The place we're tuning in is as easy as getting a White House press pass if you're a gay hooker. Indeed. Somebody sent me a note saying, you know, if you made so much money with Langley St. Clair, how come you were starting the travel agency, you know, holding your breath? Well, Louise and I have always had this strange policy. This is one of those don't do as I do, do as I say. We'll build up a business, sell it off, and then basically retire for a year or so. And in fact, the last one before I started this radio show, we sold an ad agency in Atlanta 9 years ago, and we were kind of out of the mainstream for several years, just writing books, and then, you know, run out of money and go back in it more or less, and just I always liked the idea of taking my retirement when I was young enough to enjoy it. And so our kids have lived in Europe. They've, you know, we've traveled around the world. It's worked out well. But it's not a lifestyle that suits everybody. So in answer to that question. Now, at FindLaw, what did John Dean say? Here's the headline of his article. John Dean, again, the lawyer for George W. Bush. For Richard Nixon. They held the same position with Richard Nixon as Alberto Gonzalez, and now Harriet Myers holds for George W. Bush. And there's talk that Harriet Myers is on the way out. That's a whole other story. Anyhow, the John Dean's piece, if past is prologue, George Bush is becoming an increasingly dangerous president. And in this article, he talks about an analysis of presidents done by a presidential historian, a fellow by the name of Barber, that... you know, who has gone through all of the presidents up through Bush Sr. And ranked them, James David Barber is his name, he's a political scientist, ranked them by four characteristics, looking at their character, their worldview, their style, their approach to dealing with power and expectations. And he found that presidents fall into a cluster of characteristics. There are those who are very active and those who are very passive. For example, JFK and LBJ were very active, Calvin Coolidge and Ronald Reagan very passive. He also found that there were presidents who loved their jobs, what he calls positive presidents, and presidents who frankly hated their jobs. They were exhausted by it. They didn't really like being president. They felt that it was sort of an obligation. Jefferson and Nixon, for example, who had negative feelings about being president. And thus they came up with these four types: the active positive, the active negative, the passive positive, and the passive negative. And what John Dean points out is that George W. Bush is an active negative president. And he says if you look at the presidents who were active negative presidents, there are only four of them: Woodrow Wilson, Herbert Hoover, Lyndon Johnson, and Richard Nixon. And he says that they tend to pursue policies. Woodrow Wilson with the League of Nations. Herbert Hoover refused to change direction even though the Great Depression had started. Lyndon Johnson refused to get out of Vietnam. Richard Nixon, pursuing his, well, if the president says it, that means it's not illegal, all the way to, you know, to the point of resignation. These previous four active negative presidents, very, very destructive presidencies. And, frankly, very dangerous presidencies. A lot of people died as a result of at least two out of the four of these presidencies that John Dean is describing. And he goes on to say that George W. Bush is clearly one of these active negative presidents. And he says that active negative presidents take risks. He says, if anyone doubts that Bush, Cheney, Rove, and their confidence, if they're talking about, you know, what we can expect in the future. Actually, let me go back here a little bit. He talks about the risk-taking of Bush. He says a few examples make that clear. He took the risk that he could capture Osama bin Laden with a small group of CIA operatives and U.S. Army Special Forces, and he failed. He took the risk that he could invade Iraq and control the country with fewer troops and less planning than the generals in State Department told him would be possible, and he failed. He took the risk that he could ignore the criminal laws prohibiting torture and the criminal laws prohibiting warrantless wiretapping of Americans without being caught, and he failed. and he's taken the risk that he can cut the taxes for the rich and run up huge financial deficits without hurting the economy. This, too, will fail, though the consequences will likely fall on future presidents and generations who must repay Bush's debts. So then John Dean goes on to say, as the 2006 midterm elections approach, this active/negative president can be expected to take further risks. If anyone doubts that Bush, Cheney, Rove, and their confidants are proposing or planning an October surprise, he says, you know, okay, now if anyone doubts this, if anyone doubts that Bush, Cheney, Rove, and their confidants are planning an October surprise to prevent the Republicans from losing control of Congress, that he or she has not been observing this presidency very closely. And then he asks, what would the October surprise be? He points out that this is the most closely held secret that this administration has right now. How risky will it be, asked John Dean. Bush is the whatever-it-takes risk-taker. The consequences be damned. He says, one possibility, Dick Cheney will resign as vice president just before the election, become a senior counselor to the president, and Bush will name a new vice president, a choice geared to increase his popularity, as well as somebody electable in 2008, possibly Rudy Giuliani, possibly Condi Rice, possibly John McCain, maybe Bill Frist. I would add to that mix maybe even Chuck Hagel. Bush's second and more likely surprise in the area of national security, maybe some sort of great powers coalition with a united no-nukes stance to Iran. But he says that's not the most likely. The most likely, Bush will mount a unilateral attack on Iran's nuclear facilities, hoping to rev up his popularity. And he says this is a risky strategy. It could light up the entire Middle East and put our troops at risk. It'd be a terrible thing. John Dean goes on to say, if there is no October surprise, I will be shocked. And if it is not a high-risk undertaking, it would be a first. Without such a gambit, and the public always falls for them, by the way, Bush is going to lose control of Congress. Should that happen, his presidency will effectively have ended, and he will spend the last 2 years of it defending all the mistakes he made during the first six and covering up the error of his ways. Scary stuff. And all the more reason that we need to be talking about this stuff and immunizing people from his October surprises right at the very beginning. I mean, this all has to do with public versus private morality and the importance of just, you know, straightforward process. Happy Earth Day, my friends. We'll see you next week.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.